Welcome to this December 2025 review of Dermatologic Surgery. We've got four main articles to walk through this month: a basic science mechanism study on laser-assisted scar improvement, a cross-sectional look at Mohs content on TikTok, a retrospective analysis tracking the progression from simple abscess to hidradenitis suppurativa, and a technique piece describing a new buried suture variant. I'll also fold in two shorter communications that ran alongside two of these pieces, since they're quick and worth knowing about. Let's get into it. First up is a mechanism exploration study out of Guangdong, looking at early intervention with carbon dioxide ablative fractional laser, CO2-AFL, on surgical scars, and specifically asking what's actually happening at the cellular level when we do this. You've probably already seen the clinical phenomenon yourself, or heard of it: treating a fresh incision with a fractional CO2 laser in the early postoperative period seems to soften or even erase the eventual scar line. The clinical effect has been reported by multiple groups, but the actual mechanism is stayed murky. This group set out to nail down the biology, with a specific hypothesis going in, that CO2-AFL activates a gene called TRPS1, which then kicks off WNT beta-catenin signaling, which in turn recruits hair follicle stem cells into the wound healing process. This is a basic science animal model study, not a clinical trial, so the methods look very different from what you'd see in a human cohort paper. They use several strains of transgenic mice, including LGR5 and KRT14 fluorescent reporter lines, specifically so they could literally watch, under fluorescence, where hair follicle stem cells and epidermal stem cells were migrating to during wound healing. That's the methodological logic worth flagging. You can't track stem cell lineage and fate in human tissue this way, so a genetically engineered mouse model is really the only tool that lets you visually confirm this specific stem cell population moved into the wound and proliferated. They made full-thickness dorsal incisions, closed them, then treated one side with CO2-AFL on day 2 post-wounding at varying energy settings, leaving the other side untreated as an internal control, a nice paired design that controls for animal-to-animal variability. They first ran a dose-finding exercise across 3 energy settings and landed on a setting of 10% density, 20 millijoules, and 300 hertz as producing the least visible incision line. That's their optimal parameter, and it's the one used for all subsequent experiments. From there, they layered on histology, transcriptome sequencing, quantitative PCR, and Western blotting to build a mechanistic case, rather than relying on any single readout. Histologically, the treated incisions had thinner, less prominent scar lines, and this showed up as early as day 3 to 7, with the epidermis actually thickening transiently, and hair follicles and sebaceous glands starting to repopulate near the incision, something essentially absent on the untreated side. Collagen typing shifted favorably too, with more type 1 collagen early and more type 3 collagen and a more organized skin-like collagen architecture by 2 weeks, versus the more disorganized pattern you'd expect in ordinary scar. On the transcriptomic side, the treated tissue showed enrichment in WNT signaling pathway genes, extracellular matrix interaction genes, and DNA replication genes, and specifically LGR6, WNT5A, and TRPS1 were all significantly upregulated in the treated group by day 7. That was mirrored at the protein level, where WNT5A and beta-catenin were elevated in treated tissue at both early and late time points. And using the fluorescent reporter mice, they could actually see it directly: LGR5 positive and LGR6 positive hair follicle stem cells, along with K14 positive epidermal stem cells, appearing in the center of the incision in the treated group by day 7, cells that simply were not present in that location in the untreated control. Putting it together, the authors conclude that early CO2-AFL intervention seems to work by activating TRPS1, which drives Wnt beta-catenin signaling, which recruits hair follicle stem cells into the healing incision, essentially recruiting an adnexal regenerative program rather than a purely fibrotic one. The obvious limitation here is one you'd expect from any translational basic science paper. This is entirely a mouse model using engineered reporter strains and a straight surgical incision, which is a much cleaner and more homogeneous wound than what we create clinically after excisions of variable size, tension, and anatomic location. There's no long-term scar outcome scoring beyond day 28, and no human validation at all in this paper. So take the mechanistic story as hypothesis generating and biologically plausible, not as proof that this pathway is the operative one in human patients. Practically, this isn't practice changing on its own. You're very likely already doing early post-op fractional CO2 laser touch-ups on high-risk scars, and this paper doesn't give you a new protocol or a new energy setting to adopt clinically, since their optimal parameter was derived and validated only in mouse skin. What it does give you is a satisfying, evidence-backed answer to the "why does this work?" question you may get from curious patients or trainees. The working model now being that fractional ablation isn't just mechanically disrupting scar tissue, it's biologically waking up follicular stem cell niches and channeling healing toward a more regenerative, hair-bearing, adnexa-preserving phenotype rather than pure fibrosis. Interesting and mechanistically satisfying, but not yet something that should change your energy settings or timing in clinic. Next, a cross-sectional analysis looking at the quality of Mohs-related content on TikTok. This falls into the state of digital health information genre, rather than a therapeutic study, but it's directly relevant to what your patients are seeing before they ever sit in your chair. The premise is straightforward. TikTok has become a major vector for health information, good and bad, and the authors wanted to formally grade what's actually circulating about Mohs micrographic surgery under the hashtag Mohs. They pulled the top 100 hashtagged videos over a 5-day window in December 2023, applied inclusion and exclusion criteria to end up with 70 relevant videos, and then had two independent reviewers score each one using three validated instruments: the Discern instrument, the JAMA benchmark criteria, and the Global Quality Scale. Using three different validated tools rather than just one is a sensible design choice here, since each instrument captures something slightly different. Discern is oriented toward treatment decision quality, JAMA toward source credibility and transparency, and the Global Quality Scale toward general usefulness to a patient. And triangulating across all three makes the low-quality conclusion much more robust than any single score would.
Of the 70 included videos, roughly 7 in 10 were created by patients themselves, and only about 1 in 7 were made by physicians, with the remainder from nurses or Mohs technicians. Across all videos, the average Discern score was low, about 1.6, on whatever scale the tool uses, which the authors characterize plainly as poor quality, and physician-created videos scored significantly better, roughly 2.4, a real and statistically significant gap. But even that physician-made average still sits well below what you'd call a high-quality benchmark. So this is a case of statistically significant, but only partially reassuring. Physicians do better, but better than poor is still not good. The JAMA and Global Quality Scale scores told the same story, averaging around 1.4 and 1.8 respectively, both toward the low end of quality. Meanwhile, these 70 videos averaged roughly 450,000 views apiece, with some individual videos reaching into the millions. So the reach of this low-quality content is genuinely enormous, dwarfing anything most of us could produce as individual clinicians. The author's discussion is appropriately restrained. They acknowledge that Discern, JAMA, and the Global Quality Scale were all originally built for written material, not short-form video, and that no validated scoring system yet exists specifically for social media video content. So these results should be read as directionally informative, rather than as a precise psychometric verdict. They also note this pattern mirrors what's been found in other dermatologic TikTok content, like acne videos. So this isn't a Mohs-specific problem. It's a broader pattern in dermatology-adjacent social media. The practical takeaway here isn't a change to your surgical practice, but it is a call to action worth taking seriously for your patient-facing presence. Patients are getting most of their pre-visit Mohs information from other patients on TikTok, not from clinicians, and that content is measurably low quality despite massive reach. Physician-created content, while still imperfect, is significantly better, which is really the actionable point. If you or your practice have any interest in patient education content, this paper is a reasonably strong evidence-based nudge to get physician voices into that space, since right now, the vacuum is being filled by anecdote. Alongside that piece, this issue also carried a short communication describing a homemade smoke evacuation device, essentially a flexible, extendable exhaust tube connected to an external fan, nicknamed by the authors as a Korean barbecue-style ventilator, designed to sit near the electric cautery or laser tip during wart treatments and adapt to different patient positions without needing to be repositioned constantly. It's a letter, not a study, so there's no outcomes data, just a practical build description. The headline number worth remembering is cost. The authors report the entire system, fan and tubing included, runs about $136, positioned as a cheap, accessible alternative for practices without a built-in smoke evacuation system. Worth knowing about if smoke evacuation infrastructure has been a budget sticking point in your own space.
though obviously this hasn't gone through any formal safety or efficacy testing against commercial units. Third, a retrospective analysis from Atrium Health Wake Forest Baptist, tracking how often patients who first present with a plain cutaneous abscess go on to be diagnosed with hidradenitis suppurativa, and how long that transition takes.
The clinical problem is one we all know. HS is frequently diagnosed late, often after irreversible scarring and tunneling have already set in. And the authors wanted to know whether the anatomic pattern of an initial simple abscess could serve as an early warning sign, essentially asking whether we're missing a diagnostic window when these patients first show up. This is a retrospective chart review spanning 2012 to 2023, built around patients who initially presented with a coded cutaneous abscess and had at least 10 years of follow-up available, specifically excluding anyone who already carried an HS diagnosis at that first visit. That long follow-up requirement is the key methodological choice here. The authors don't spell out their reasoning explicitly, but a 10-year window makes sense if you're trying to capture a diagnosis that might not emerge for years after the index abscess, which is exactly what they found. They then compared anatomic location of the abscess, demographics, and comorbidities between those who eventually got an HS diagnosis and those who never did, using standard chi-squared and t-test comparisons. Out of 471 patients meeting inclusion criteria, 71, about 1 in 7, were eventually diagnosed with HS, and that HS group skewed heavily female at about 80%. Patients who went on to develop HS presented with their first abscess significantly younger, on average around age 20, compared to age 25 in those who never developed HS, a 5-year gap that's both statistically significant and clinically meaningful, since it suggests earlier abscess onset itself is a soft warning sign. The average time from that first abscess to an eventual formal HS diagnosis was about 2.5 years, though the range was wide, anywhere from the same month to as long as roughly 12 years, underscoring just how variable the diagnostic delay can be. The anatomic clustering finding is really the headline result. Abscesses in the axilla, the inframammary fold, and the inguinal folds were all significantly more common in the group that eventually got diagnosed with HS. For example, axillary involvement showed up in roughly 1 in 3 of the eventual HS patients, versus only about 1 in 7 of those who never developed HS. And that gap was statistically robust. Inframammary involvement showed a similar pattern, and inguinal fold involvement as well. By contrast, anagenital and back locations did not differ significantly between groups, meaning those sites are far less specific for predicting a future HS diagnosis. When the authors grouped all the typical HS distribution sites together, patients presenting with an abscess in one of those typical locations were roughly 7 times more likely to eventually be diagnosed with HS than patients whose abscess was somewhere atypical, a striking and clinically intuitive signal. On comorbidities, diabetes, obesity, hyperlipidemia, and other dermatologic conditions were all statistically more common in the eventual HS group, though the absolute differences were fairly small in several cases. Obesity, for instance, at about 21% versus 20%. So those associations are statistically real, but not something you'd necessarily use alone to flag a patient. The authors are appropriately honest about the limitations. This is a single-center retrospective study. It doesn't capture abscess patients managed through primary care or the emergency department who never made it into dermatology's charts. It relies on ICD-10 coding accuracy for both the abscess and the eventual HS diagnosis. And patients captured toward the tail end of the study window may simply not have had enough follow-up time yet to manifest HS. They also note their own diagnostic delay figure of roughly 2.5 years is actually shorter than delays reported in other cohorts using patient-reported symptom-to-diagnosis timelines, which have run as long as 7 to 10 years. So methodology and data source clearly affect how delayed this looks. For practical purposes, this is a genuinely useful pattern recognition tool rather than a definitive diagnostic algorithm. If you're the one lancing or excising an abscess in the axilla, inframammary fold, or groin, especially in a younger woman, this data supports a low threshold for asking about recurrence, family history, and other stigmata of HS at that very first encounter, rather than waiting for a second or third recurrence to raise the question. It won't change your surgical management of an acute abscess, but it's a reasonable nudge toward earlier counseling and referral in the right anatomic context. Last, a technique piece describing the buried clothesline suture
presented as a variation on Yag Howard's zipper stitch. As a communication rather than a study, there's no results or limitations section to walk through. This is purely a description of technique and the author's rationale, so let's go through the mechanics. The original zipper stitch is a running buried vertical mattress closure with two tie points, one at each end of the incision, using a loop between the last two throws to bury the knot. The modification here collapses that down to a single tie point at the distal end only. The key maneuver is what they call the clothesline. At the proximal end, a buried vertical mattress suture is placed, and rather than tying off immediately, the free end is stretched by a hemostat or assistant along the length of the wound bed, running along one side of the excisional edge. Subsequent running buried vertical mattress sutures, placed every 3 to 4 millimeters, are then thrown so that they incorporate this clothesline strand as they cross from one side of the wound to the other, essentially lashing the whole running closure to that single long strand before the final knot is tied and buried a few millimeters below the epidermal surface. If a subcutaneous inverted cross mattress stitch is also being used, the clothesline is simply passed beneath it. Polyglaprocrone is their suture of choice, low friction, and easy handling, and epidermal edges can be reinforced afterward with cyanoacrylate glue or Steri-Strips if desired. The stated rationale, straight from the authors, is that this design needs only one surgical tie point instead of two, doesn't require a separate epidermal suture, and, because the clothesline strand can be tensioned progressively like a purse string as the closure proceeds, gives you adjustable control over both hemostasis and final incisional length, depending on how much tension you dial in before the final knot. They're upfront about the trade-offs too. It uses more overall suture material, though they don't think that meaningfully affects cost, and there's some add-in chair time spent managing the loose clothesline end until the desired tension is achieved. As a practical takeaway, this sits squarely in the useful technique refinement category, rather than practice-changing territory. It's a reasonable option to have in your toolkit for closures, where you want adjustable, purse-string-like tension control, and eversion with a single buried knot, particularly on longer or higher tension excisions. But there's no comparative data here on cosmetic outcome, closure time, or complication rate versus the standard zipper stitch or a conventional running buried vertical mattress. Try it if the concept appeals to you, but don't expect published outcome superiority to back it up yet. Riding along with that piece was a short How We Do It on Button Osteoma Excision, a straightforward technical walkthrough rather than a study. The steps are simple. Mark the incision along relaxed skin tension lines. Infiltrate with lidocaine and epinephrine into both skin and the subgaleal space. Incise down to subcutaneous fat, and then redirect along the frontalis fibers to the periosteum. Incise the periosteum at the base of the osteoma, and elevate it to expose the lesion clearly. Then place a 1 cm straight osteotome tangentially at the osteoma's base and use short mallet strikes to separate it from the calvarium, smoothing the bony surface afterward if needed, and closing in layers with absorbable suture under a pressure dressing. No outcomes data is presented. It's purely a procedural pearl for a lesion most of us encounter only occasionally, so it's worth bookmarking for the next time one crosses your schedule, rather than something requiring any change to how you already think about these lesions. That wraps our 4 main articles and their companion pieces for this December issue. The through line this month is really about early recognition and mechanism, recognizing HS earlier from abscess location, understanding mechanistically why early laser intervention might improve scars, and being honest about where our patients are actually getting their information versus where we'd like them to get it. Thanks for listening, and I'll see you next issue.